Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today I'm very, very excited to do a show on a recent book that came out, and the book is called Vanguard of the Imam: Religion, Politics, and Iran's Revolutionary Guards. And today we have the author of this book, Afshan Ostervar. So first of all, thank you so much for coming on the show, Afshan.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I read your book. It's fantastic. It's chocked full of so much information on Iran's Revolutionary Guards. However, there's all kinds of other information on Iran, some of the historical background, religious aspects, current aspects. And as I was saying before we started recording, I had a lot of trouble trying to encapsulate as much as I could in this show because the book is just fantastic. I highly recommend our listeners to read it. I read it fairly quickly just because I couldn't put it down. So first of all, thank you so much for writing it. It was a great read.
Well, thanks for reading it.
And just so our listeners know, Afshan is a senior analyst at CNA, and he will be joining the faculty at the Naval Postgraduate School. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It'll be a fun move.
Why don't we start off with just discussing how this book came into existence and what was your reasoning in writing it?
Well, it germinated, you know, as a doctoral dissertation. And when I was struggling with a topic to write on sort of doctorally, I was wrestling with a lot of things. I wanted to write on political Islam in a way. I wanted to write on culture. I wanted to write on contemporary issues. But I also had a background in I was a historian. I came out of the history department. And I had a background in even early modern history. So I wanted it to be historically grounded, but sort of with an eye to the contemporary. And sort of as an Iranist, as somebody who was writing on Iran anyway, and somebody who was interested in sort of Shia political movements as well as sort of the broader political Islamic kind of phenomenon, the IRGC kind of just naturally emerged as a group that was fascinating because it was a political organization, it was a religious organization, it was a very important piece of the post-revolutionary Iranian state. But it was also not something that had received much attention at all. And so it was kind of ripe in a way in that it was underwritten and I think underappreciated. And so it was kind of an exciting topic to approach for that reason.
And personally, I've read a lot on Iran, Iranian politics, history, and this book in general had so much information that I haven't found in other books. And it just fascinated me because there are times when I'd be reading the book going, oh my gosh, I never knew that, even though I've read about this exact happening or topic. And you just have so much detail and so many little things that are not published in the mainstream. So you really melded everything that you just said, your reasonings for writing this book.
Thanks. It was, you know, some people, it depends how you sort of approach your dissertation. Everybody in a history department comes up with a prospectus, and usually that prospectus kind of gets thrown out the window as soon as you start writing because you realize, well, I had wanted to say all these things, but you're kind of bound by the sources that you use. A historian is, at least. You don't start with a theory generally. You start with sort of whatever your sources are. And so the book developed sort of mostly by what was out there, what I could get my hands on, and what I thought about it. So what it became was as much a book on the Revolutionary Guards as it was a book about Iran, sort of modern and contemporary Iran, particularly the post-79 Islamic Republic, told through the lens of the career of the IRGC. And that became a really sort of an interesting aspect of the book, for me at least, was that I was able to write a history of post-revolutionary Iran, but from a particular angle, and an angle that I thought, for the most part, had not really been considered. You have a lot of historians that have written on Iran from a Marxist or class perspective, from a political perspective, from a religion perspective, and economic and other areas, but sort of by looking at this one sort of military political organization, you know, using that and the politics of that sort of genre as a lens is something that I really hadn't seen before. And that's sort of organically what the book became.
So to kind of go over some of the aspects in this book and talk about issues today and issues from the past in Iran and with the Revolutionary Guards, why don't you just tell our listeners who are Iran's Revolutionary Guards?
Right. Well, put it simply, the Revolutionary Guards are a military organization. Iran has two militaries. They have several armed forces, but two main militaries: the regular military, also known as the Artesh, and the Revolutionary Guards. And the Revolutionary Guards was started as an alternative to the regular military, which was the military of the pre-revolutionary period. But since its establishment, the IRGC has grown into something much larger than just a military organization. That's sort of their core, their bread and butter. But they've become really a pillar of the Iranian state. They have a very important role in foreign affairs and foreign policy. They have a large hand in Iran's economy, although that's difficult to understand and poorly understood at the same time. Sometimes it's exaggerated. They are very closely linked with political issues in Iran and with power in Iran, but not always in a way that makes complete sense from the outside or even the inside. So to sum it up, I would say they're a military organization that has immense power in Iran.
So Iran had this really horrendous war, the Iran-Iraq War. It lasted many years, and the IRGC played a very important role in the war. So kind of looking at the historical aspects of the IRGC, what type of role did they play in this war, and how did the war shape or change the IRGC?
Well, it's an important question, because when the Iran-Iraq War began, September 22nd, 1980, the IRGC wasn't even 2 years old. It was a young fledgling organization. It was really a very sort of factionalized organization. It had started as an umbrella group for several different sort of smaller armed groups. That what brought them together was the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of Iran, and loyalty to Khomeini. But other than that, they were a pretty disparate organization, and they were filled mostly with either activists, sort of revolutionary activists that had maybe done some training outside of Iran with the PLO or with other groups. So maybe they knew how to use guns or explosives or whatever. But mostly it was populated by just youngsters, people, teenagers, people in their young 20s who wanted to be part of the new revolutionary regime and saw sort of volunteering for its new armed force as that path to service or whatever. So when the war began, the IRGC was not a military. It was a hodgepodge kind of armed group that didn't have any clear role in the post in the state. The regular military still controlled strategic policy for the most part. War fighting had all the material, the technology, the artillery, the tanks, the airplanes. All of those things were only the regular militaries. The IRGC was really just basically a militia. But over time, the IRGC grew in importance in the war. And this happened for two reasons. One, because of its political clout. It was trusted by Khomeini's lieutenants much more so than the regular military. And part of the reason why it was trusted is because the IRGC approached the war in sort of in the same way that they approached revolution, in the sense that they believed in sacrifice, they believed in bravery and boldness, in sort of creative thinking. They ascribed this idea that Iran was sort of oppressed and in some ways made weak by outside powers, but they believed that sort of their zeal, their religious faith, their politics, They believed in the righteousness of those things, and they felt that that by itself was going to help propel them to victory because they were on sort of the right side of history, the right side of God. The regular military, this is not to sort of besmirch the regular military, it was in an uncomfortable position because early after the revolution, it was still associated with the previous regime. And so what happened right after the revolution is much of its top leadership was purged. They were either literally jailed and killed, or they left the country. And so the regular military itself was, for the most part, under the leadership of mid-ranking officers. So their sort of brain trust had been thrown out the window. So neither armed force was in a good position to fight a war against Saddam Hussein and his forces. So this allowed the IRGC over time to slowly assert itself in the war. And basically what happened was the war was a failure for Iran for the first year and a half. Saddam Hussein was able to, his forces were able to take key territory, including this strategic important city of Khorramshahr. And all, the regular military was for the most part, as well as the civilian leadership, were blamed for these losses. The IRGC came up with a tactic that ended up paying great dividends at the start of these spring offensives in 1982, which culminated in the retaking of the city of Khorramshahr. And the tactic that the IRGC used, which it kind of fell into using, was something that they called human wave attacks, or that I call mass infantry movements. And these things were basically just thousands of Revolutionary Guards who were lightly armed, you know, AK-47s, rifles, maybe grenades, maybe a handgun. And they would literally charge into and overwhelm Iraqi front lines. And so they would exhaust and overwhelm Iraqi front lines by literally exhausting the ammunition that the IRGCs had to bring to, or that the Iraqis had to bring to bear, and then slowly pushing the Iraqis back. The Iraqis had never seen anything like it before, didn't understand it. It seemed like madness to them. It was kind of just sort of, you know, the way one Iraqi military officer described it was, it was like the mass crush of people coming out of a mosque on Friday that was just never ending. And they were just firing into dead bodies after a while. But this tactic ended up really working. And it ended up, through four major offensives through 1982, ended up pushing the Iraqis back across the Iran-Iraq border for the most part. And that's really what shifted the war completely, sort of put it in Iran's favor. But it really is what established the IRGC not only as sort of a formidable aspect of Iran's military power, but also as sort of the more forward-leaning, the more creative military force. And those victories established it politically within the regime as well. And so it gave the IRGC a seat at the table in terms of sort of the overall war planning. And sort of through its legitimacy, through its political connections, and through its sort of part within the regime itself, its credibility, the IRGC slowly, through the war, became the top military force. So that's a very long answer to your question of the development of the IRGC during the war.
Well, that's good, though. It's a good example and a good intro if someone might not know a lot about that war. And in the sections in the book that deal with the Iran-Iraq war, and especially the human wave attacks, which were really interesting to read about, I've heard about them, of course, and studied them, but the association in the book with Karbala, with the IRGC's idea of a Shia concept of martyrdom, was so interesting, and how this imagery played into the narratives of the Iran-Iraq war. And I think that aspect is also very timely with current issues going on. So could we discuss that somewhat?
Sure. So I begin the book with sort of a short history of the establishment and creation of Shia Islam and sort of the Shiite sort of founding episodes. And the most important, or one of the most important culturally to the Shia is the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who was the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad and the second son of Ali, who was the first Imam. And Hussein died. Many people may remember this story or know this story, but Hussein died on the plains of Karbala in southern Iraq. And his martyrdom by the hands of the Umayyad dynasty, who was then sort of the head of sort of the Sunni world, his death created in many ways the cultural core of what became the Shiite religion. The commemoration of his death that happened at Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram, is today, to this date, still the most important day in the Shiite calendar. In many ways, it parallels sort of the Passion of the Christ, the martyrdom of Christ, his crucifixion. The Imam Hussein is a very similar figure in that way. In many ways, you know, Christ died for the sins of everyone, and in many ways, Imam Hussein's sort of story is similar to that. So, because it's such an important part of Shiite history, of Shiite culture, of Shiite identity, the fact that the Iran-Iraq war was playing out in the same area as the creation of Shiism itself was not lost on the revolutionaries, was not lost on Iran. And it was something that they both, I think, believed in, but also that also sort of spoke to, that they used it for their messaging. They used it sort of for their wartime propaganda. They used it to rally their troops and to motivate them. And the idea was basically that the Shia had been wrong throughout history, and the Imam Hussein sort of had never been truly redeemed in a way. And this was an opportunity, that is to say, the war with Iraq was an opportunity to not only sort of rewrite that history and right those wrongs, but to retake the area, to liberate the area, rather, literally Karbala, and Najaf and these areas in southern Iraq that were so important to the Shia and had been under Sunni dominion for so long. And not just Sunni dominion, I think that's the wrong way to put it because that's not the way that they phrased it, but rather sort of foreign dominion, secular dominion, you know, satanic dominion. It was not sort of, it was not something held by the Shiite community. And so the Iranians, and the IRGC in particular, described the war in many ways as a means of liberating Karbala, both sort of spiritually, metaphorically, but also literally. And so the goal of the war was not only to defeat Saddam Hussein and to topple him and to liberate Iraq, but was also to sort of retake the sacred ground. And so they used this metaphor of liberating Karbala very liberally in their wartime propaganda. And so, you know, to die in the Iran-Iraq war was in many ways sort of repackaged and re-seen as sort of dying, you know, for Hussein himself. You know, it was as if they were fighting the same battle that Hussein had fought, that Hussein was ultimately defeated. It was as if they were fighting that same battle, but they had a chance to win it this time. And that was something that was really interesting to me because it was a very powerful metaphor. I mean, you can never, you know, as a historian, I can never say that people believed in this or not. I'm sure many believed in it. I'm sure many did not necessarily believe in it, and they fought anyway. There's lots of reasons to fight for your country, and religion may be one of them. But the way that the IRGC used it, they did use it in terms of faith. They did use it in terms of sort of religious identity, and that made the war so much more powerful, I think, for the Iranians than for the Iraqis, because they weren't just fighting for power. They weren't just fighting for victory or for conquest. They were fighting essentially for their faith. You know, they were fighting for the pride of God and for the pride of their prophets and the imams. And this is something that I think just gave the Iranians far more fuel to fight that war than anybody anticipated them having.
And in the book, you have some great visual signs and posters that fall into this narrative of Karbala and show this narrative being played out in their propaganda. So I just wanted to throw that in there for people that might be interested in reading the book, because it's not just the text. There's also visuals in the book, which are very, very interesting.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, historians are limited in the sense that, you know, we basically draw from text, or we draw from you know, people's memories or whatever. But one of the things that I've always found interesting as a source for understanding identity and politics and ideology is the other ways that those ideas are articulated. And one way that appeals to me, that's very interesting to me, and I've worked on this both on the jihadist side and on the Iranian side, is visual propaganda or visual culture. And visual culture was very important. It's very important in Iran, you know, writ large. It was very important during the revolution. And it was very important to the IRGC, because visual sort of productions, visual culture is a way of expressing, you know, really complex ideas in a very simple, straightforward way. You know, like you can think of sort of the power of symbols, right? Like, you know, the hammer and the sickle and the hammer for the Soviet Union, or, you know, any of the Marxist symbols like a five-pointed star or something like that. Or you just think of the importance of ISIS's flag, right? Yeah, the black and white flag that they use. These are powerful symbols that may or may not say anything with words, but they immediately say so much to those people that either adhere to those ideas or to that group, or those that oppose them, right? And I thought that the IRGC's sort of visual productions, both in its, especially sort of within its publications, was a way to get at how they used these statements, these ideas, in a powerful way that wasn't just through text, but that was through artwork and for the lack of a better word, sort of repackage these things, both for internal consumption, as I say, for their soldiers, but also to articulate it to outsiders.
And I want to kind of move the discussion post-Iraq war and move into current times as well. So what happened to the IRGC after the Iran-Iraq war? In the book, you mentioned that one of the most important parts that they played was the involvement in the reconstruction campaign in Iran's industrial capacity. And this is a really important moment for the IRGC, so let's discuss that.
Right. So after the war, the IRGC was in many ways terrified that regardless of how important they had been during the war was for the most part a failure from Iran's perspective. They didn't achieve any of their solutions. They basically sued for peace along with the Iraqis. I mean, it was a mutual agreement, ceasefire. But they didn't achieve anything, and they exhausted their economy. They exhausted sort of their sort of social political capital. Iran was a broken state by the end of it. And the IRGC in many ways had been one of, not the only, but had been one of the engine that drove the war as long as it went on. So for many reasons, the IRGC was nervous that they would be sidelined or marginalized or weakened. But that didn't really happen. You know, ultimately what Iran's leaders were faced with, and this is basically President Rafsanjani, who was president for most of the 90s. What he was faced with was basically a broken economy and, you know, this giant mobilized military that now had to be demobilized and had no clear role in peacetime. You know, you think about it, the revolution happened in 79, the Iraqi invasion happened in 80, and basically through 88, you had a war. And so the Islamic Republic never really didn't know what peace was. They didn't know you know, what the role of any of these institutions that they had built up during the war, what sort of role they would have when there wasn't a war. And the IRGC was sort of top of that list. So what Rafsanjani ended up doing as a way of sort of holding on to the IRGC, as a way of trying to sort of, I think, cultivate a stronger relationship with the IRGC, but also just to give them something to do and a way to fund themselves, because funding was such an issue, was that he opened up state contracting, industrial state contracting, to the IRGC and to other parts of the Islamic Republic, other organizations within the state. And the IRGC, I think, is the one that benefited the most from it, in that slowly its engineering corps was able to become, through the 90s, the largest state contractor in Iran. And so what began as sort of a way to help the IRGC fund its own operations became this you know, major side of the IRGC, where it became not only the most important state contractor, but also a very important player in Iran's economy. So it diversified the IRGC's role. It gave it a role within the economy, but it also gave it more power. And I think this is what Rafsanjani didn't necessarily intend, is that the IRGC suddenly had a real stake not only in the Iranian state, but also in maintaining its role in the Iranian state, right? So, I mean, you can just think of it this way. You give a person a high-paying job, it's really hard to claw that high-paying job back from them. You know, they're not going to cede it willingly. You can fire them, but you can't ask them to sort of give it up, right? So the IRGC has been in, basically since the 90s, been in the position of either maintaining or expanding in its influence, not retreating from areas where it has been allowed to be influential. And so I think that's why sort of that small effort by Rafsanjani at the beginning of the 90s, the beginning of sort of reconstruction, post-war reconstruction, really shifted the IRGC from just a military to a real serious player in the Iranian state.
What roles does the IRGC fulfill today, and how would you compare the relationship with Rouhani, a president, and I'm going to put this in air quotes, who has sought to work with the United States? So, as you mentioned, there's this connection with the Supreme Leader, the president. IRGC is kind of working with all of them and also, in a sense, working on their own. So what are they doing today, and what is their relationship with president, and looking at current relations with Iran and U.S. and negotiations, how is that all playing into this?
Well, I'll start with their relationship. So the most important relationship that the IRGC has always had is with the institution of the Supreme Leader in Iran. It was created as the vanguard of Khomeini. It was his armed force in many ways right after the revolution, and that's how it operated. But Khomeini had a good sense of balance, and so he balanced the interests of the IRGC and the regular military and of the clergy and different parts of the clergy the best he could. The IRGC became more powerful under him. But he also, you know, didn't just allow them to do whatever they wanted. In the 90s, this changed, and it changed mostly because the IRGC broke from Rafsanjani fairly early in the early to mid 90s over political issues, over economic issues that are complex, and I talk about in the book. But suffice it to say that the IRGC never really got along with Rafsanjani that well, even though he opened up the doors for them to really become far more powerful. Instead, the IRGC became far closer to the new Supreme Leader after the war, Ali Khamenei. And Khamenei is important because, unlike Khomeini, his predecessor, Khamenei had no natural base of support when he became supreme leader. Khomeini was a very important marja or grand ayatollah. He had a very large network of students and of lay followers. Khamenei did not have any of that, really. He had allies, but he didn't have followers. And so what Khamenei had to do was he had to find a pillar of support or a support base that would give him some oomph or some sway in Iranian politics. Otherwise, he was going to be basically outmaneuvered and overrun and overwhelmed by Rafsanjani, who was a more savvy politician and seemed to have a better ground game, as it were. And what ended up happening gradually was that Khamenei saw in the Revolutionary Guards and really the war veteran class writ large as a natural base of support. And they became sort of the core of what we now call sort of the hardliners. But Khamenei became very closely linked with the IRGC at this time. And the IRGC became very, very loyal to Khamenei. And so Khamenei's position during the 90s, as it grew especially in the 2000s, as he became sort of the uncontested supreme leader, who really is, I think, far more powerful than sometimes we give him credit for being, really began to rest on the IRGC. The IRGC was his baton, right? It was what afforded him influence at the ground level and at the political level, literally through both the support and the coercive apparatus that the IRGC represented. So the IRGC has been far more connected with the supreme leader than with the presidency in Iran. And for that reason, it's never really needed to be subservient to the president. It's always been, I don't want to say parallel to, but it's occupied its own space. And so depending on who the president was or is, the IRGC has allowed them or maybe been forced to by the supreme leader to allow that president to be influential in certain areas. But if the IRGC really differs with the president on certain issues, it has many ways and mechanisms to sort of coerce or compel that president to either change tax or at least to frustrate his policies or his initiatives. So under Khatami in the 90s, who succeeded Rafsanjani, the IRGC was for the most part antagonistic. Under Ahmadinejad, the IRGC was for the most part in lockstep until the last few years. Rouhani has been sort of a mixed bag. Rouhani politically comes from sort of a side of Iranian politics that for the most part the IRGC does not support. He's not himself a reformist, but he comes from sort of a pragmatic wing like Rafsanjani that does not see change as necessarily a bad thing. The IRGC is above all sort of status quoist. It doesn't want to change major policies internally or externally. Now, one area that has been somewhat controversial is whether the IRGC supported the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, or not. The IRGC certainly in sort of the statements by its officials was not very supportive of the nuclear deal. They criticized it. They criticized Rouhani. And so for many people believe that the IRGC didn't support it at all. I tend not to believe that fully. They certainly played it as such that they saw the nuclear deal as perhaps a red herring. But in my opinion, and as I discuss in the book, they didn't go out of their way to stop it. In fact, in many ways, they allowed it to take place. And I think they allowed it to take place because it benefited them. The removal of sanctions will benefit them. The protections that JCPOA inherently gives Iran in that it sort of took the threat of war from the United States off the table, or at least pushed it down the road, greatly benefits the IRGC. Also, the nuclear deal, in a way, normalized the IRGC's behavior or activities in the Middle East, whether it's in Iraq or Syria or Lebanon or whatever, because those weren't on the table, so to speak. They weren't really discussed. You know, the IRGC feels like, okay, they got a nuclear deal, but they didn't really have to give up much. But what they did give up, because they came out against it, at least tepidly, was they gave up some domestic political face or capital, right? They were seen as the losers in the nuclear deal domestically because they had come out against it, because it had succeeded, because the Supreme Leader had supported Rouhani. They were seen, or at least I think they think that they were seen as the losers. So one thing that I think is going to define or partly define domestic Iranian politics going forward is going to be a tension or a conflict between the IRGC trying to sort of reassert its interests domestically, at the same time preventing the nuclear deal from being sort of a slippery slope to change, right? They don't want the nuclear deal to create an atmosphere of political opportunity and political change in Iran. They don't want normalized relations with the U.S. right now. They don't want sort of a spread of Western pro-democratic mores or values to be spreading in Iran. And that's going to be a tough battle for them, because in many ways they realize that the nuclear deal created new aspirations for Iranians, especially those that voted for Rouhani. And the IRGC is going to be in the business of either curbing those aspirations or reversing them. And I think that's going to be a difficulty for them with Rouhani as president. Rouhani has been pretty deft at dealing with the IRGC. He's criticized them in some ways, such as in their role in the economy. But he hasn't gone too far to the left, as it were, to really institute policies that would be difficult for the IRGC to accept, right? So he hasn't really called their bluff in a way. So right now you have a somewhat, I don't know, not tense situation, but a situation that's sort of simmering. But I think in the future the tensions might not bubble over, but I think they'll become far more realized than they are now.
You mentioned sanctions, which in the media, in academia, in politics, is a huge issue surrounding Iran. And looking at sanctions, how have sanctions affected the IRGC during the Obama administration?
Well, it's difficult to know precisely how it impacts the IRGC directly. I mean, because the IRGC has ways of getting around sanctions that, let's say, the normal Iranian business does not. So most of what we know about the IRGC in this regard, as sort of the sanctions busting kind of activities, is difficult to confirm, right? So there's a lot of sort of rumors and ideas and talk about the IRGC having sort of black market activities. We know that they're involved in a lot of sort of different types of smuggling and different capital ventures and different shipping and money laundering and these sorts of activities that have allowed them to sort of get around sanctions to some degree. On the other hand, we know that Iran as a state has suffered immensely from the impact of sanctions. You know, in many ways, their economy is really struggling. And this must and has certainly affected the IRGC. I mean, the IRGC is involved in two wars very prominently, the war against ISIS in Iraq and in support of Assad in Syria. And that doesn't come cheap, no matter what the level of their involvement is. And without a strong economy, without oil prices being high, and with sanctions in place, the IRGC was certainly, you know, having to cut corners and having to do things on the cheap. So from my perspective, it impacted them greatly. And the reason I believe that is because I believe that they supported the nuclear deal to get sanctions removed. And I believe that their motivation for doing that was to open up Iran's economy so that they could get more money, so that they could fund their operations better. But it's difficult to say precisely in what ways it's impacted them outside of the financial sphere. In terms of sanctioning certain individuals, this may have complicated those individuals' sort of access to foreign bank accounts or whatever, but it doesn't seem to have really impacted the individuals at all. I mean, Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC's foreign wing, the Quds Force, seems to travel to Russia, you know, periodically, if not routinely, despite sanctions against him and a travel ban, right? So long as other countries are willing not to sort of or look the other way on these sanctions, those individuals really haven't been impacted.
Moving the discussion towards much more current issues. So let's say post-Iraq, well, even during the 2003 Iraq War, and then through to the Arab Spring, as a general point, how does the IRGC incorporate sectarianism into their policy and strategy towards its neighbors? And in general, would you consider this to be a successful strategy for them?
Well, it's, I think it's, you know, it's complicated. The IRGC, I don't believe, has used sectarianism in the way that Iran's foes or neighbors accuse it of doing, in that I don't think it uses, it's certainly not rhetorically, does it use the language of sectarianism the same way that, let's say, Salafi jihadists use the language of sectarianism for their politics, right? So you'll never hear the IRGC really disparage Sunnis directly. They often emphasize sort of pan-Islamic concepts, pan-Islamic unity, that sort of thing. And I think to some degree they actually believe that that's what they're doing. But in practice, what has really happened is that the IRGC's best friends, the people that it's closest to, are its clients. And those clients that some people call proxies, although I don't really like that term, the client groups that it supports to that have sort of, that has been able to cultivate the closest relations with, are those that are from the 12 or Shia fold, particularly in Lebanon and Iraq. And those relationships are built partially on politics, but largely on shared religious identity. You just can't get around it. So the IRGC, you know, is willing to be friends with whoever is willing to be friends with it. They were close with the Venezuelans under Chavez, for instance, right? And that's, you know, an atheist, secular, socialist, you know, Latin American, you know, post-Catholic, whatever kind of regime that had no pretense of being, you know, Muslim and certainly not Shia, but it was willing to spend time and collaborate based on shared political interests. So the IRGC is not above or below, however you would put it, working with, ideologically different groups. But it works best with other Shiites. And the Shiite-based clients that's developed in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and in Iraq, which is several groups, have their sort of basis, you know, in relationships that even pre-existed the revolution, and really with the Iraqi groups were forged during the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, the Badr organization itself was established, organized, trained, and operated as an arm of the IRGC or a division within the IRGC during the Iran-Iraq war and during the 90s. And it became, you know, an important pillar of the post-Saddam Iraqi state and became particularly influential in the Iraqi security forces. So here you had essentially an adjunct of the IRGC becoming, you know, a very important player in Iraqi politics and the Iraqi security forces, which allowed the IRGC inroads into sort of the Iraqi political sphere in general. But because Iran's support within Iraq and within Syria have been basically along sectarian lines, and because those groups themselves often are sectarian in their outlook, they look at things very differently than the Iranians do. It's created this sort of de facto sectarian strategy that the IRGC is either developing or playing into, depending on how you look at it. Iran's neighbors see the IRGC as a purely sectarian actor that's very overtly developing Shiite clients and radicalizing those Shiite clients against Sunnis and Sunni states and Sunni regimes in order to essentially colonize the Middle East through a literal spreading of Shiism by the sword, right? That's the biggest fear, and that's the belief that a lot of Iran's neighbors have. I don't think the IRGC is that deliberate about it. I think for them, this is a means to an end, and the end being both growing Iranian influence, propping up Iranian pro-Iranian regimes, whether in Iraq or in Syria, and third, protecting Iranian interests from the growth of radical Sunnism, especially the jihadists, right? So it's kind of a vicious cycle in the sense that Iran is trying to combat sort of anti-Iranian forces, whether they are states or whether they are sub-state movements like the jihadist movement. And they do that through relationships, through funding, through training and organizing their own sort of Shiite militias and groups. And so this creates this sectarian dynamic that sees really no, that I see no end in sight of, you know, at least at the moment, because both sides, that is to say Iran and its neighbors, are playing into it. And despite what they want to achieve, are kind of behaving in a way that's just perpetuating the cycle of sectarianism.
Considering all that, how do the events that happened in Bahrain and then currently the events taking place in Yemen play into all of this?
Well, it's, you know, they happen within this context of spiking sectarianism for one, and then the Arab Spring second, right? So you have this, one, you have this fear on the Arab side of this growing Shiite menace, right? And this really happened with the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and sort of the empowerment of pro-Iranian Shiite forces in Iraq. That was a big blow to the Arab states because Saddam Hussein had been sort of the check on Iranian power or influence in the region. And without him, Iran now was able to spread its wings a little bit more or spread its influence a little more. But even more problematic, Saddam Hussein was replaced with essentially pro-Iranian Shiites from their perspective. And so it was kind of this worst case scenario for Iran's neighbors. And so what they feared is that Iran would sort of take this turn of events and try to do something similar in other places. And Bahrain is one of those places that would make the most sense because it's a majority Shiite country. It has a Shiite population that's for the most part disenfranchised from the ruling Sunni minority. And Iran has always had a relationship with Bahrain that's complicated and historical, but suffice it to say that that Iran has always seen Bahrain as part of its natural sphere of influence. It's difficult to know precisely how the IRGC has been involved in the unrest in Bahrain. I don't write a lot about it in the book precisely because it's difficult to ascertain. certainly the Bahrain regime feels very strongly that the IRGC is sending weapons and money and training individuals within Bahraini groups in Iran, you know, in the development and of knowledge and production of explosives and these sorts of things. And that may be true, but it doesn't seem that Iran is investing so much in Bahrain as they have in, let's say, Iraq or Lebanon or Syria. So it's difficult to know what Iran's real end game is if they are supporting these Shiite groups to that end. If nothing else, it's certainly keeping unrest alive and perpetuating that unrest. But they're not funding them to the extent that the Shiites can actually do anything or really seriously challenge the Bahraini state. But Bahrain and the GCC states all feel very strongly that Iran is actively trying to overthrow the Bahraini ruling family. And so this escalates their fear of what Iran is trying to do, right? I mean, their worst case scenario, and this even happened right after the revolution, was that Iran was going to try to spread its revolution, which was as much Shiite as it was anti-monarchical, right? The revolutionaries in Iran overthrew the Iranian monarchy, and you have to remember that Iran's neighbors are all monarchies for the most part. So they're as afraid of Iran's political ideology as they are of Iran's religion. And they see Bahrain as sort of, you know, the next piece to fall. And so they're trying very, very hard not to allow that to happen. Same with the unrest in eastern Saudi Arabia. And Yemen fits into that narrative, right? The IRGC has had longstanding relationships with what they call Ansar Allah, or what's generally referred to as the Houthis, which is a Zaydi Shiite organization. But again, the Iranians seem to have been clearly arming the Zaydis and arming these groups in their sort of in the war that has developed in Yemen and even previously. But Iran is in no real position to help the Houthis really overthrow or control, that is to say, the Yemeni state. What the Houthis seem to be doing is really, I think, driven far more by their own calculus, or by the calculus that's sort of endemic to Yemeni interests, their Yemeni interests, or the interests of the former president, Abdullah Saleh, and less the IRGC. But what Iran's neighbors see is that Iran is trying to do in Yemen what it did in Iraq, what it's doing in what it did in Lebanon, what it's doing in Syria, what it's trying to do in Bahrain. So for Arabs' neighbors, this is all pieces of a puzzle. And as one Emirati academic told me a few years ago, you know, they feel surrounded. They believe that Iran has Yemen, that Iran has Bahrain, that Iran has Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, and that Iran has Africa. And really, the Arabian Peninsula and the states of the Arabian Peninsula are now being encircled by this growing sort of domineering, sort of emerging Shiite empire, as they see it. But there are many nuances that Iran's neighbors don't really care to appreciate, and that many outside observers don't care to appreciate. And one of those is just the fact that Iran's strongest relationships are with Twelver Shiites, Lebanese Hezbollah, the Iraqi groups. Every relationship below that is driven far more by political interests, you know, sort of aligning political interests. And the Houthis are a very distinct Yemeni organization. And while we call them Shiites in the sense that they diverge from the Sunnis in terms of how they approach leadership after Muhammad, they're really very far afield theologically, culturally, in terms of identity and belief and practice from the Twelver Shiites. They're a very distinct religious movement that is as old as Twelver Shiism itself. And there's really not a lot of commonality between them and the Twelver Shiites in Iran or Iraq or in Lebanon. So there's not that commonality that Iran can really build on. There is politics, and there is sort of shared enemies, whether it be Saudi Arabia or the Salafis and jihadists. But in terms of long-term sort of strategic interests, I don't think that the Iranians and the Houthis are going to see eye to eye forever. There's a lot of differences between their interests and what they want to achieve. And I don't think that they have a strong enough basis for it to really last that long or develop into the same kind of relationship that Iran has with, let's say, Lebanese Hezbollah.
Moving away from the Gulf and heading towards the Levant, we have Syria, big topic. So how would you describe the IRGC's involvement in Syria? I know this is a really big question.
Right. Well, it's twofold, really. One, it's historical. Two, it's sort of in terms of contemporary interest. In terms of history, Syria has played a very strong role. The Hafez family has played a very strong role in supporting Iran in many ways, and the Iranian revolutionaries in many ways over the years. So for one, during the time of the Shah, Hafez al-Assad in Damascus allowed Iranian revolutionaries to come to Damascus and through Damascus go to Lebanon and train with the PLO or to work with other Shiite groups in Lebanon and essentially harbored Iran's revolutionaries and allowed the revolutionary movement to grow outside of Iran. Once the revolution happened and the Iran-Iraq war began, those relationships were maintained, and Syria emerged as really the only friend that Iran had during the Iran-Iraq war. All the regional states went against Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, supporting Saddam Hussein in one way or another. Even the PLO, which Iran had been very close with, began to support Saddam Hussein. But Syria under the Assads was different. It supported Iran and it did certain things during the war to help Iran and to help its war effort. And Iran never forgot this. And the IRGC certainly never forgot this because they still bring it up to this day. It is basically the basis of their relationship going forward. And over time, their relationship became closer because they were the two outside patrons to Hezbollah. And really, the Assad regime was sort of the intermediary or the middleman between the IRGC and Hezbollah and allowed the IRGC to facilitate that relationship, to keep that relationship, to arm Hezbollah. And Hezbollah really, in many ways, was Iran's most important strategic asset in that it was Iran's most credible way of threatening Israel. And Iran's ability to threaten Israel was really the biggest leverage that Iran had with the United States. So all of these things are connected. So Iran's involvement in supporting the Assad regime began very quickly after unrest in Syria began. Very early in the days of the protests, members of the officers from the IRGC and officers from Iran's police and other security forces went to Syria to help advise them on how to put down the protests and then later how to put down the insurgency and the rebellion until later, you know, Iran started sending, you know, both funds, troops and materiel, arms to Syria to help Assad defeat the rebels. And it did so on the basis of loyalty and its strategic interests. So on the one hand, it's very loyal to Assad and the Assad family, who have been friends of Iran, sort of the Iranian revolutionaries since before 79. But also, the Assad regime is the gateway to maintaining a strong Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they don't want to lose that. So for Iran, Syria is everything. It is the key to its sort of strategic vitality and viability, and it's also sort of a test for how Iran sort of treats its friends, you know. And the IRGC often likes to make this point to differentiate what they do versus what America does, let's say. And that is, they not only support their friends, but they will fight alongside their friends, you know? And so part of the, part of sort of the hubris, in a way, of the IRGC's dedication to that sort of idea is that its officers, its commanders, literally go on the front line with the troops. And this is one of those reasons why you have such a high casualty rate of IRGC officers in Syria. It's because they're not just in an office, you know, calling the front lines to see what's going on and coordinating from afar. They're literally on the ground at the front lines fighting alongside their men. It's a much more fraternal, equalitarian, if not egalitarian, kind of ethos that they bring both to military structure, but also to war fighting. And it's interesting from my perspective to see this carry forward through today, because it's something that was certainly alive during the Iran-Iraq war. And it's interesting to see them not abandon it today, even though they've spent, you know, almost 30 years since that time developing. So their involvement in Syria is very robust. They're not only training and supporting pro-Assad forces, but they're also developing a cadre of pro-IRGC, pro-Iranian militia that in many ways seem to be in the mold of Lebanese Hezbollah or the other Iraqi militias that Iran and the IRGC have helped establish. And the sort of the success of this establishment of this Syrian militia, you know, is difficult to assess now. Right now, it's in the midst of fighting a war. What will really sort of test, you know, whether Iran was able to not only, and the IRGC were not only able to train and develop a politically supportive network of armed militants, but also, in a sense, export their revolutionary ideas, their ideology, their system, their way of doing business to Syrian counterparts, is to see what will happen in a post-war or post-Assad context. And so that's, of course, yet to be seen. I would suggest that because Iran's and the IRGC are developing this network out of essentially Alawites and, to a lesser extent, Christian militants, that it's going to have a harder time forging into something as strong and enduring as Iran's clients in Lebanon and Iraq, which are based on sort of Twelver Shiite networks. If Iran is able to sort of create a viable clientage in Syria, then I think it will have, through the IRGC, successfully exported sort of its revolution beyond its border into Syria. But because of the reasons I've stated already in discussing Yemen and other places, I think the Alawites in Syria are not well predisposed to being a long-term client for the IRGC. They may politically be aligned for a long time, but I think I think that alignment is going to be maybe not easily, but potentially disrupted by other political concerns that the Assad government can have over time, assuming the Assad government stays. Just a quick example, the IRGC only has so much to give the Assad regime. It only has so much money. It only has so much weaponry. There's not a lot that it can give that it hasn't given already. Russia, on the other hand, has quite a lot that it could give. And it may come to a point where Iran and Russia, who don't seem to see eye to eye on preserving the Assad regime, it may come to a point where the Russians try to entice a post-Assad government by promising essentially the moon, promising something that Iran cannot counter on. And I think that will really be the test ground for the resiliency of Iran's support network within Syria. Right now, it's certainly formidable and important, as it's fighting a war. But I think the more players that come to that conflict, the more complicated it's going to be and more difficult it's going to be for the IRGC to maintain that network.
And do you think this counterinsurgency that the IRGC and Iran is waging in Syria, does it point to a weak government of Iran? Is this sort of a last stand to gain ground in the region for the country?
No, I think what it is mostly is that the Iran itself, writ large, you know, the government, the supreme leader, the IRGC, all see foreign investments as absolutely crucial to the security of the Iranian state, right? So in many ways, what has protected Iran from a war with the United States is, ironically, its foreign adventurism, its creation, development, and arming of Hezbollah, which was you know, its only its strongest credible threat against Israel, and also the development of Shiite militias in Iraq during the American occupation of Iraq, which were enabled to harass U.S. forces, to keep the pressure on U.S. forces, and were always this tacit threat that were the U.S. to go to war against Iran, that Iran could turn up the temperature in Iraq quite significantly through its network there. So in many ways, the IRGC has been able to prove to the Supreme Leader that its method, its path towards establishing security for the revolution is the best, and it's best born out of this combination of foreign adventurism, building up foreign clientages amongst mostly militant networks, and also creating a deterrent at home, which in this case is mostly, I think, realized in Iran's ballistic missile program, which is large and difficult for Iran's neighbors to contend with. So this sort of two-part system that the IRGC has been able to establish is really the heart and soul of Iran's strategic deterrence. And it's something that all presidencies have acknowledged. So Khatami, Ahmadinejad, and Rouhani have all tacitly or outwardly accepted that these foreign relationships are important. And it's important to stress that the governments in Iran, that is to say, the civilian governments run by the president, have never gone against the IRGC in this way. They've never really seriously tried to divorce the IRGC's foreign operations from Iran's own strategic behavior. It's always been important. And one reason why I think that is, one is because it's true, it has worked. There are many things that also could have worked. Iran could have just normalized relations with America and the West and never had a problem to begin with. But that's of course water under the bridge. But the initial sort of foray into foreign operations, exporting the revolution, developing Hezbollah, etc., were all sort of the initiatives that came out of what I call the Khomeinist left, or who we now call sort of the reformists. The reformists were the most radical revolutionaries in the early revolutionary period. And for them, sort of developing and spreading, developing networks outside of Iran and spreading Iran's revolutionary ideology through those networks beyond Iran's borders was really their project. And so they lost out over time in terms of power, but I don't think that their sympathies for developing foreign clients and foreign networks has really been diluted much over the years. And so we tend to think of, in the West, we tend to think of this bifurcated system in Iran. The hardliners are this way and the reformists are that way. And we we tend to think that the foreign stuff, Hezbollah, Iraq, Syria, etc., is really the hallmark and the purview of the hardliners, and something that the reformists, by being, you know, inherently more open to relationships with the West, would somehow want to do away with should they be in power. But I don't think that's the case. They may change the way that Iran went about it. It may look different, but ultimately I think that that is the one area where the Iranian regime is mostly unified. It's not really a problematic policy. And it's one of those things that the reformists and hardliners agree upon, and that is sort of supporting Iran's foreign allies.
To bring the talk to a conclusion, I want to throw out a big question that, reading the book, popped into my mind, and it made me wonder, so I will put it out to you, since you're the author, you're the one that has studied this topic in depth and so well. So, if Khamenei were no longer the supreme leader, does the IRGC have the power to someday rule Iran, or is the supreme leader or a supreme leader ultimately needed?
That's a terrific question, and it's a question that lots of people wrestle with. And so I'll state up front, who the hell knows? You know, I don't know. You know, anytime you talk about the future, everybody's wrong. But I certainly talk about it in the book, and so it's only fair to talk about it here. And the way that I look at it is like this. To me, the relationship between the supreme leader and the IRGC is really the heart of Iran's system. The IRGC sees itself as literally the defenders of Iran's system, its Nizam, its form of government, its form of politics, right? And that is essentially this system that is governed by the supreme leader, right? So the IRGC, above all, sees itself as a defender of the institution of the supreme leader, not as the defender of the revolution, just period, but as the defender of that institution. That's really what the revolution means to the IRGC more than anything else. Now, that has all sorts of, you know, policies and whatever proclivities and persuasions sort of wrapped up in the idea of the institution of the supreme leader, but that's really the heart of it. So many people have argued that the IRGC has already sort of become more powerful than the supreme leader, and you know, it's only a matter of time before they essentially rule Iran directly, or even, you know, mildly indirectly, as essentially a military junta, right? And they point to examples like Pakistan or Egypt or Myanmar, or other countries that are essentially ruled by the military. And there's a lot to say for that. The IRGC is very powerful. It does have a very close association with Iranian politics. And it does in some ways, you know, exert that influence in ways that that normal militaries don't. On the other hand, because the supreme leader's institution is so important, to me, it would take an absolutely fundamental shift in identity for the IRGC to rule Iran directly should the supreme leader die and not a suitable replacement be found. I don't think they want that responsibility. I don't think that they need that responsibility, and I don't think that they crave it. They need to have a supreme leader. They need that institution to be there in order for their role to have any saliency, right? They're the defender of the supreme leader. They're not the supreme leader himself. Now, the IRGC certainly doesn't want a supreme leader that it totally disagrees with, right? Like if you had an equivalent to the current Pope, let's say, become the next supreme leader, who's progressive and nice and engaging and all of these things, I think the IRGC wouldn't accept that supreme leader very long. It would find one way to either discourage him from being too progressive or sidelining him in many ways and empowering others. But most likely it would never come to that, because the IRGC would probably have some say or sway in the choice of the next supreme leader. through, you know, various means. So it's most likely that the next supreme leader will be more or less on board with maintaining the status quo of the IRGC's position in the Iranian state. However, just like the last, when Khamenei came to power, the last sort of changeover, the next supreme leader likely is not going to have a base of support. And that supreme leader is going to need a base of support. And the two bases that it can really seek would be either sort of the Iranian populace, the people, right, to be a populist supreme leader, or to go sort of with the status quo and sort of put your support or cultivate support with the IRGC. And if it cultivates support with the IRGC, I think basically things remain status quo. Maybe the IRGC gets a little stronger, maybe it gets a little weaker, but for the most part, it remains the same. If, on the other hand, the next supreme leader chooses to be a little progressive and sideline the IRGC or marginalize them to a bit by appealing to regular Iranians and the Iranian electorate, and trying to use electoral politics as a way of shaping Iranian policies, as opposed to using the military to do so through coercion and other means, then I think this opens up a potential conflict between the supreme leader and the IRGC and puts the IRGC in a really uncomfortable position, which is either, you know, essentially maintaining peace and security within Iran, but accepting a lower status or decreased power, or challenging the heart and soul of the system by going against the supreme leader and trying to jockey for more power by going against the supreme leader and the Iranian people. And in that scenario, you have sort of a recipe for unrest and political turmoil in Iran that I don't think it's really encountered yet. But from my perspective, the sort of Islamic Republic and its leadership have been elastic enough over time to not rock the boat too much. I think the unrest in 2009 is a real blip on that radar. But I think in many ways, the election of Rouhani and the signing of JCPOA is sort of a reaction to what happened in 2009. And this is what I'm getting at in terms of flexibility or elasticity, is that the IRGC, as much as it wants to maintain its own power and its own influence, it also doesn't want to completely create a context in which its position in the Iranian state could be seriously challenged by popular revolt. And so I think for that reason, it will be more or less pragmatic with the next supreme leader. But I also think the next supreme leader will probably be on board with the IRGC regardless. So if anything else, you'll see more of the same rather than drastic change, I think. But like I said, I'm probably totally wrong, because who knows? It's the future. And if the Arab Spring taught us anything, it's that things happen, you know, that are totally unexpected. And go in ways that you really don't anticipate, and that it's really difficult to anticipate. So it's hard to speak with any certainty about the future, but certainly that's the way that I'm looking at it. Those are the dynamics that I think are most at play.
The book is Vanguard of the Imam: Religion, Politics, and Iran's Revolutionary Guards. And thank you for writing this fantastic book.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.